Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your very favorite weekly libertarian podcast, brought to you by the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. June the 5th be with you, colleagues.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
That's right. So they're calling it, and by they, I mean some columnists at the New Yorker, or New York Post, I should say. Little difference between the two. The revolt of the normies. It began with consumers of Bud Light abandoning the beer brand in droves to protest a promotional campaign featuring trans micro celebrity Dylan Mulvaney. It continued with a similar semi-spontaneous boycott of retail giant Target for offering tuck-friendly one-piece women's swimsuits for penis havers who prefer women's swimwear. And then the Los Angeles Dodgers baseball team, that last bit was for Catherine, sponsored, then unsponsored, and then re-sponsored a night honoring a Catholic satirizing drag nonprofit called the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, generating backlashes on basically every side of every issue, including among several Dodgers players. And all this was before the beginning of Pride Month last Thursday, I believe, is when it started. On Thursday, as I watched on local television here in Southern California, outside a North Hollywood public school, parents and activists scuffled in protest and counter-protest at the school holding a Pride Month assembly attended by, among others, kindergartners, wrote the aforementioned New York Post columnizer Stephen F. Hayward. Far from merely wanting to be tolerated or left alone, the new transgender movement insists on transgressing every institutional and social boundary, from bathrooms to sports to the elementary school classroom. Counters California governor and gay marriage pioneer Gavin Newsom, and I quote, "There is a full-throated purge effort going on here by the far right that we have not seen for decades. They are on a boycott binge and cancel crusade." Who's this speechwriter? Trying to eliminate the existence of minority communities, end quote. Catherine, libertarians tend to be conscientious objectors. In the culture wars, more concerned with abuses of government force, such as blocking gay marriage by law or gay adoption, even rather than giving even a little one crap about the brands and their various campaigns and sub product lines. But there is also a lot of government in some of these stories, particularly when it comes to public schools. So let's start there. Should Catherine Mangue Ward, that's a comma and a comma, kindergartners be going to pride assemblies? Should they be asked about their pronouns? And who should be deciding such things?
That's cool. It's just like a little gentle start for our Monday morning.
Sorry.
Like, not a big one to bite off. Yeah. I mean, your preface is very right, which is that my first impulse on all of this is like, can people not mind their damn business? Like, that's just in my heart. Like, it's tattooed on my heart. But of course, there are places where this is going to become a question of a zero-sum question, which is what happens when government gets involved. I think that everything can be done in an age-appropriate way, and we are figuring out how to do that, and everyone is choosing to pretend like it, like this is an irresolvable question for their own purposes, right? So, like, sometime in June, maybe the children could be exposed to some like very basic age appropriate. Hey, like not everybody's gender and sexuality is like the same thing as in the Dick and Jane reader that you still use because public schools are garbage. Let's talk about it a little bit. Also, though, maybe we don't need mandatory attendance at the kindergarten drag show during school hours. Like, it doesn't seem like it should be that hard. And we've figured it out for so many other things already, right? I mean, I'm old enough to remember when Black History Month was still kind of like people used to get sassy about it. And now it's like, we're basically fine. We figured it out. And, you know, likewise for all these other kind of days, weeks, months, whatever, where we recognize difference, I think that's appropriate. But I will hold firm to the line that Target can do whatever they want and people can shop there or not, that the Dodgers can do whatever they want and people can baseball there or not. People can't, I don't know what the verbs are, Matt, attend. And that that is simply the business of the team, their fans, their advertisers. Like, that's an economy. That's a whole thing that's already worked out. We don't need to reinvent this in the pages of the New York Post.
Peter, you're from Florida, and that has become kind of ground zero for a lot of these fights, in part because the governor there, Ron DeSantis, has made that part of his...
That's how we say it.
We say it winner. That's how we pronounce his name, winner.
I think we got to adjust our pronunciation. It really is DeSantis, according to him, I think.
DeSantis. No. It's like, you know, when they start corporate rebranding sports arenas, I just know. It's not called Staples Center. It's called the place where the Lakers play. And of course, it's now like crypto.com. So congratulations, America. Anyways, what's your name? Peter? Yes. So Ron DeSantis has made that part of his national profile to be fighting these things. When Republicans talk about him, they tend to say, hey, look, he's prevented the penis havers from competing in girls' sports at schools. He's been rooting out some of the kind of embedded activist infrastructure in the education department. He's taken sex and gender stuff away from kindergartners. And all of that is broadly popular in Florida and probably in America as well. And then when Democrats talk about the same thing, or at least talk about him in the culture war, they're saying he's banning books, he's whitewashing history, he's driving gays back into the closet, all of which are unpopular, broadly speaking, among the American public. So you, Florida-deriving libertarian person, is there a third way for thinking through these conflicts?
So actually, I want to start not by talking about DeSantis, but by talking about another state's governor who you already mentioned, Gavin Newsom, who ended his tweet that you read from with, if we go silent, this will only get worse. We cannot become numb to this. And guess what? I am numb to this. I just don't care anymore. And I would not be talking about this except for the fact that I'm on a podcast where Matt's going to ask me questions and going to say, hey, Peter, you got to talk about this. And it's all over. It has totally infected like every single dinner party conversation I've been to for the past couple of years. Like all of the Bud Light trans Target underwear like fiasco of national life, right? Whatever the hell that is. Like I want to make a good cocktail and see a good movie and not think about this. But of course, some people have to think about this. And so here is my answer, which is also a cop-out. My answer is, when you put this in Slack as the topic we were going to talk about this week, the lead topic, I just thought, I don't want to talk about this. Also, this is why I'm a libertarian, because the whole problem with all of these fights is that people want to push all of these discussions into the realm of governments and into the realm of public ownership, public schools, state laws, city laws, right? Like public bathrooms, like what, all of this stuff, right? And they want it to be, they want it in some sense to be decided at the public level. And that is absolutely the wrong way to do it. And so in some ways, I want to push back just a little bit on what Catherine said. You know, Catherine's argument is, well, there's a common sense way to sort of answer these questions and we can work all of this out. And that's true to some extent. But the way that we work it out is by agreeing that maybe the common sense way that you think that we should do it will not be the same as somebody else. And that different people are going to have different opinions about this stuff, and that's okay. And what we want is to maximize the freedom for people, for individuals, for families, to make choices on their own, to opt out where possible. And the more we push this stuff into the realm of Ron DeSantis decides, the worse this gets.
I want to point out in my defense for talking about this issue that people are...
No, it's a totally reasonable thing, and I'm being difficult and grumpy because it's Monday morning, and you're like, "Hey, dude, let's talk about the Bud Light trans wars." Come on, just let me drink my coffee.
I think 2 months ago, or whenever the Bud Light thing first came on, was making a monthly appearance on the Megyn Kelly podcast, and she's going hard on these issues these days. I think she went to me first and said, you know, what's your reaction to the Bud Light thing? And I said, my reaction is I want to die. That's my initial reaction too. But as I mentioned at the top, this does come with a lot of government involvement, and it might be affecting public attitudes. There's been some recent polling that the long slope upward of public acceptance of gay marriage is flattening and going down in some places as well in different age cohorts. And it's not all the olds. Some of the youngs are kind of starting to dip downward. So, Nick, you said the other week, I think loudly, I'm just guessing, that conservatives lose every culture war. I'm not sure Bud Light and Target agree with that assessment. Is it possible that the winning side went too far and kind of demanded everyone clap like Jeb Bush whenever they have a Pride Month or have a, a spokes troll or an Abe Greenwald's formulation in Commentary Magazine hawking the brands that are otherwise not really part of that issue set is not part of the brand's popularity to begin with?
Yeah, I don't think so. And it also remains to be seen because when the latest flap about all of this came out, particularly about the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence being, feted at the Dodgers by the Los Angeles Dodgers in 2016, when Target announced that it would allow, customers to choose which bathrooms they used and which dressing rooms they used. There was a short-term backlash, and conservatives pounced and said, this is the backlash against Target because they've gone too far, blah, blah, blah. And they talked about how their earnings went down. And within a couple of weeks, it turned out that, Target's stock price bounced back up, et cetera. It had nothing to do with anything. So I think looking in the near term about this and about, Bud Light, because Bud Light is the bellwether of everything that is meaningful in 21st century America, the fact that Bud Light sales went down by about 18% over the past couple of weeks and Coors Light, and Miller Light went up by about the same amount. We'll see where we are in a while. About 2/3 of Americans believe that trans people should be covered by anti-discrimination laws, which, of course, doctrinaire libertarians don't believe in. Where there is flux, even among Democrats, is what do you do with kids? Most people, I think, agree that parents have a wide say on what happens with kids, but not an absolute say. That's kind of the battleground. But this isn't simply about public school. Because a lot of the policies that are most contentious actually are emanating from private schools. It's happening in places like Major League Baseball. We'll see where it comes. But the thing to me about this is also it's a libertarian cop out to say that once we privatize all the spaces, this conversation will go away. Which I would like to see happen. But I also know a lot of libertarians who are really foregrounding trans rights issues as somehow this is the thing to be talking about. I hang out with a lot of libertarians and a lot of them are like, I refuse to be forced to say that a man can become a woman or vice versa. When you ask them exactly what that means, it kind of starts to fritter away a little bit. I think there is a legitimate debate, for the people who have kids in public schools, what books are included in libraries and some of the stuff that's celebrating trans issues is graphic and is probably, I wouldn't want my middle school kid to be looking at books that, graphically depict sexual activity for the most part. In Utah, we're seeing troll bans on things like Bibles in public school libraries because people figured out, hey, there's a lot of obscenity in that. So
I love that.
What
so
we're
much.
Talking about here is, and something is happening like that in other red states, but it's a bigger issue than trans stuff. But I don't think, the idea that trans people are now all, like dunking on conservatives and who are beleaguered. And I loved Trevor Williams, Matt, the Washington Nationals Catholic pitcher, who, is incensed that the Dodgers were, commemorating or, lauding the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. who are drag queens, who, you know, who dress up like nuns. We'll come up with something else to fight about. But, you know, I don't think this is, you know, a particular moment where attitudes are going to shift and we're going to see a rollback against, you know, a lot of these social gains that have been made by alternative lifestyles.
I just think you're missing an opportunity to decry the last acceptable prejudice, Nick, against your Catholic brothers and sisters.
Of course. No. But while the problem is that on July 30th, of course, the Dodgers are going to be having Christian Faith and Family Day. So, you know, we'll see how upset and butthurt the Satanists are and the queers and the lesbians and the gays and the trans, you know. But I mean, all of this is it. I don't want to say it's unimportant because it matters to a lot of people, including, again, like, I don't know how many libertarians I've talked to recently who are like, I will never be forced to say that a man can become a woman. That is insane. And, you know, like, I don't know that America, to be quite honest.
The Heritage Foundation was just supporting, and I've lost it on my phone because it just came into my brain, but like a counter Pride Month now. I think it's called like Tradition Month or something.
It's close. That's very college campus in the 90s energy. Like, they're going to have a affirmative action bake sale.
Catherine,
I just say,
so how much does it cost for a trans man to buy a tampon at a, you know, I don't know, in an anti-trans bake sale or something?
It's, that's like, how we're going to fund the military in a just world.
Yeah. Which, by the way, of course, and I do enjoy this, you know, the military is totally pro-LGBTQ, and the CIA and the Navy and the Defense Department is all adorned in, you know, a rainbow of colors now on Twitter, because, you know what? You can be trans and you can kill people in foreign lands just as well as anybody else.
But they just canceled a drag show on a military base in America. So are we even the land of the free? Go ahead, Catherine.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in some ways, the place that this debate really loses me is the sort of purported cause. Like, there's this argument somehow that depending on how the trans debates, both in the public and private sector, resolve, that there's like a lot more at stake for our country and our civilization after that. And I think that's the thing. Like, I struggle with the connection of like, okay, let's say every single person in America now has a bespoke pronoun. Gender ceases to exist. Here we are in the world that that the conservatives fear. ... What? And I think, you know, there's this story about like the dissolution of the family and all that kind of stuff. That has been the threat that has been kind of held over every cultural change, at least since the 60s. And maybe the family has dissolved. Maybe the argument is like, yes, look at the state of the family. We were right. On the other hand, you know, divorce rates are down, teen birth rates are down. Like, there's, you know, there are all these kind of trends that certainly pull against that. So I guess the thing that I'm always interested in is like the people who want to make this central to our politics. Do they really think everything is at stake in this debate? Because that's the tone. And I personally just can't quite see the mechanism whereby a really aggressive Pride Month or like some inappropriate books in a public school bring down the Republic. And so I think shoulders of people who are making that argument to fully flesh that out. And again, I think there is something to the, okay, well, we just want to have kind of traditional mores and we want to have a Judeo-Christian ethic in our society. And this undermines that, but it still doesn't quite get you all the way to the apocalypse.
No, I agree with you. And this is all a moving target because it's not a Judeo-Christian country. If you're talking 1950, it's a Christian country. It was gay marriage that destroyed everything, except that, you know, marriage rates are, you know, basically the same before and after the Obergefell decision, right? You know, we need to take seriously the fact that people want to fixate on this, but ultimately it is not a issue that is going to define us, especially from a libertarian point of view, because I think the right answer is people should be allowed to live however they want to live and they can celebrate that and you don't have to celebrate it. I'm particularly piqued because recently I had conversations with a number of people who are libertarians, and they say, I refuse to be forced to do this or that. And they're not being forced to do anything. They, you know, people don't want to be shamed for saying, I think that trans people are mentally ill, which is a conversation that I've been having with a lot of people. And that's, I think, a very distinct conversation or debate, which is a realistic one about, okay, what do you do about kids in this case? Because it's clear, you know, the attacks on gender affirming care or what that means, you know, covers a lot of ground. Because, I mean, should parents or should kids who are under the age of, say, or who are prepubescent be getting, you know, definitive surgeries or something like that, or medical interventions? That's a question I think almost everybody agrees is worth discussing. And the state has a role in that on some level. But now we're trying to blow it up into these larger conversations that ultimately have less to do with any particular issue and more, I think, a sense of fear and anxiety about a future.
So I can actually explain the argument about how this, like, how this leads us to the apocalypse, because basically the argument here is that gender or sex, as traditionally construed, are biological scientific facts about the world, and that if you deny that, if you suppress that from public understanding, then you're denying a physical scientific reality about the world. And doing so in any realm, but especially one as essential to human existence as the biological distinction between male and female, threatens to undermine not just the sort of a whole bunch of stuff about society in this sort of the male-female divide, but also the entire world of knowledge production and our ability to understand the world as it is and in reality. And I think that's where you get sort of cranky libertarians who are like, I refuse. The people that Nick is talking about, the people who are like, well, I refuse to ever say or be forced to say, you know, that that someone can change their gender or change their sex. And that is, I think, part of the argument that is a little more relevant to libertarians than, say, some of the stuff about sort of family and gender roles, just, you know, and the traditions associated with them, is that some people feel like this is an ask or a demand to deny a physical observable reality.
It's a 2 + 2 = 5 argument.
Right.
And I think there's something to that, because everyone will eventually get to a place where they're put on the spot to use a singular pronoun or use a plural pronoun to describe a singular person. And so you have to respond in that moment, and you can respond by being cranky about it. You can respond by just using it, or whatever. But like you, it's put upon you to say either 2 + 2 = 5 in that little micro way or not. And it makes people cranky. Go ahead, Catherine.
This is the argument that has appeared. I mean, it's maybe most famously recently made in Closing of the American Mind, right? Like, this is Alan Bloom saying this rise of kind of relativism among the youth will ultimately lead to a kind of, you know, this kind of break with reality, the 2 + 2 = 5 moment. It is my personal experience that when you use a they, them pronoun, reality remains intact. And that, in fact, I am still able to discern true things about the world. And in fact, that not only that, but reality remains intact even when I say stuff like, oh, I really like your new haircut, when the haircut looks like shit, for instance, that
hey,
you can, in fact, sort of use words in ways that are socially acceptable and polite without undermining truth claims or the possibility of truth claims. And again, I think these conversations are really interesting and worth having, not to be all Nick Gillespie about it, but like, I think the causal claim that by they theming enough people, we like fall into a kind of Lewis Carroll psychedelic landscape in which like we are all mad here, does not seem to have been true starting from this moment, you know, more than half a century ago, when people began worrying about it, when conservatives began worrying about it in this specific vein.
They're always worried about the breakdown of the status quo. But it's also like, you can talk about, you know, sex as a biological thing and gender as a cultural expression or a social construction. You know, even Jordan Peterson says, he'll call, you know, anybody by the name that they prefer. You know, Matt, I think about this in terms of like, is Cassius Clay's real name Cassius Clay or is it Muhammad Ali? And like, are you going to be the person 20 years on, you know, do you call Deirdre McCloskey Donald McCloskey? Because that was
some people do,
her
right?
birth name or what?
Some people like
yeah,
trolls
I know.
Do.
And like, they're good luck. Yeah. Good luck with all of that. And it doesn't mean that Donald McCloskey, you know, was born a woman and can have, you know, children. We can keep all of these things constant. And I like the way that Catherine was talking about it, that, you know, none of, you know, to acknowledge a trans person's preferred pronouns and identity, you know, in no way makes it impossible to find a cure for cancer. And if people want to conflate this, or then they get upset because people say, you know what, you're kind of a dick if you keep, you know, calling a trans man, you know, a man by and using masculine
pronouns. It's the other way around.
I just don't understand the, thank you, the anxiety about this kind of stuff. And somehow that, you know, and it does seem overwhelmingly to be, you know, conservatives, but not completely, but men whose masculinity is threatened by a kind of profusion of sexual identity.
Can I put in a request that we do not use the phrase calling someone a dick in sentences that have already that much gender confusion?
It's a social construction of the penis. We could use the other, we could use the C word. Maybe that's better.
A gender-free genital epithet.
A light and friendly dick joke to transition us out of this segment. Mm-hmm. And you got to go. You got to go all in. Okay.
I'll tell you, Matt. Go ahead, Peter.
I just wanted to say, I do think that there's an answer to the question you asked earlier about leftist overreach that we should talk about just a little bit, which is that I think that a different way of thinking about this is that the culture war issues have come to the fore of our politics in part because the governments as a force for like economic policy and programs and spending has become less obviously relevant to everyday life, right? So we saw $6 trillion. I will keep saying that number because it keeps being really, really big and really shocking. $6 trillion in pandemic spending over the course of a year, starting around March 2020 through about March 2021. We have seen since then annual budget deals that push spending levels ever higher. And how many ordinary middle-class people can feel the difference? Like, how much of an actual change is that making in your day-to-day life, right? For these, you know, when we've grown the federal budget from $4 trillion to $6 trillion. And the numbers are insane, and they don't mean anything to people in a direct sense. And so people are latching onto these things because they see stuff being talked about at church, because they see, you know, what's happening in schools, because this is something that at least feels like it has a real and direct connection to their lives and to their families in a way that the whole sort of like lefty, the Biden-Trump government just has kind of disconnected from a lot of people's everyday lives because it has wasted a huge amount of money with nothing obvious to show for it.
To answer Catherine's query about what actually happens in this world when the dominance of the they them people when here's what happens. Since I live in Brooklyn and I have an 8-year-old who has been in a class with at least one they for I think her entire schooling existence, what happens is that you'll be walking down the street with your 8-year-old and you'll see a pigeon and you'll say he, and she'll say why do you think that's a he, what, maybe it's a they, why wouldn't you just say they? Or you'll see someone driving a car and I'll say, yeah, the way this woman's come down in her car. Well, how do you know she's one? So that's what happens. And I think we can live through it.
Your kids were going to be smartasses regardless of the of the methodology.
They always find a way, Matt. It's actually genuine.
My youngest's face, really, that's how she sees the world. Like, you don't make assumptions about biological assignments. And don't refer to her classmates as he when they're not there. And that's where I draw the line. All right. So I will say they in front of their face, but it's a he to me. when I'm home, and it's a boy. Anyways, that's all the reactionary moderation we have time for in this segment of the podcast. We're going to go to the listener question segment of the podcast here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, are you spending enough time on you? Is your life, work, family, relationship balance all about everybody else's needs without checking in on the person who is listening to this advertisement on this podcast? It's easy to get so caught up in your day-to-day responsibilities that you forget to focus on the most important person, or at least the person you have the most control over, in theory, in your life, you. That's where BetterHelp Online Therapy comes in. BetterHelp is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that has helped many, many listeners of this very podcast. All you have to do is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist, then start working on your own damn self for a change. Stop feeling overtaxed like, I don't know, a resident of the city of New York. Just visit betterhelp.com/roundtable today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder to email your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Sterling Gray, which sounds like a law firm or an ad agency. He writes, As I've leaned further into libertarianism over the past decade, I've started to wonder if the major distinction between libertarians and the two major parties is that libertarians are process-focused and the others are results-focused. This might be why, as Nick mentioned in the May 22 roundtable, that libertarians have a more difficult time articulating a vision for the future. The two major parties articulate a vision by promising to carry us to glory on their shoulders no matter how they get us there. But when a libertarian stands up and says, "My vision is to get the hell out of your way and let you figure it out," it isn't as inspiring to our frail mortal minds. It is more difficult or scary to imagine our own ability to achieve the life we want, and more comfortable to let someone else shoulder that burden. This may also be why, as Nick further mentioned, that we use a lot of energy simply lambasting, my word, everything that comes down the pike, his words, I'm 40, I'm still too young to use that phrase, I'm reading here, it's not me interjecting, when a new idea or candidate comes forth, we are immediately drawn to the way it, she ignores the ideal process, i.e. maximize individual liberty, whereas others may be simply listening to hear the promise at the end of that process. What say you? Is this the theory of everything that explains why libertarians are simultaneously better and more challenged? Nick, you've been named twice. You get first answer.
I was hoping to go last, Matt, but I get where the letter writer is coming from, and maybe, but I think mostly the trouble that libertarians have found in the political realm is an inability to point to outcomes that are good, that other people would like. And we need to just, you know, both in terms of electoral politics, but more broadly in selling the ideas of freedom, is pointing to outcomes that are not, you know, the only thing that could happen, but that are good things. And so if you talk about, you know, something like Whole Foods, you know, Whole Foods is a great outcome that came out of a libertarian mindset and out of libertarian actions and principles and policies, including the mind of John Mackey and his colleagues at Whole Foods, but also free trade policies and innovation and, you know, working around stupid regulations in order to recreate just a fantastic space, you know, it revolutionized what it means to go to the supermarket so that you can have like as many types of tomatoes as you can dream of, or potatoes or whatever, and a really cool experience. Things like the smartphone, things like Burning Man. You know, we need to be able to point to more real world outcomes and explain why they are the product of a more libertarian world rather than a less libertarian world. I used to talk to people in New York about, like, you know, if you like the difference between Greenwich Village and Lincoln Center, you know, these are the differences between a libertarian bottom-up world, you know, more, you know, roughly speaking, and a more command economy for cultural products and things like that. I think we need to be working that angle as much as also talking about process.
Catherine, what say you about the process versus results divide or theoretical divide?
Yeah. I mean, I want me some results. I'm kind of a results gal. But I like Nick, I see what the questioner is getting at here. I think he's onto something. But I think there's this kind of temptation to say nobody else is playing the game fairly, but we are, or we would, if you would let us play, something like that. And it is certainly true that the two major parties are currently not showing a lot of respect for process or being terribly neutral on outcomes that are arrived at via legitimate process. And it is this very true thing that libertarians do have this problem of saying, I can't promise you a specific future if we do things my way. I can only promise you process. So that, I think, is right. But, you know, I think that most libertarians, if you push them on it, they wouldn't say, hey, if we put the series of rules that I want as I'm describing them right now into place and it immediately collapses into like fascism, that like we did it. Like we're so committed to process that we just then like go with the fascism. That typically is not how it goes. So yes, I think like more emphasis on process. And of course, the king of this is Justin Amash, right? Like he is Captain Process. And that has been a really valuable counterweight when he was in the House and now as a kind of gadfly to the willingness to just like cheat, steal, you know, pull hair, whatever that's going on the Hill at this point. But I don't think it's the theory of everything. I think it's the tail of the elephant of libertarianism or something.
Peter, you affirmatively liked.
That was very well chanted.
I think I understood it.
I was trying to speak
to
Matt.
Metaphorical promiscuity. Yeah.
It's trying to get me from looking out the window at the black crows circling over the palm trees. Peter, you liked this question on Slack. Translate your liking of this question on Slack to an answer.
Well, first, I just want to say I'm really excited for the Captain Process movie. Like into mm-hmm. the process verse.
Sure.
I want the process expanded universe.
It's sidekick pluralism girl. Like, I don't know. It's not going to be good.
Now, one of the reasons I like Justin Amash is because he's a process guy and good processes are important because good processes don't predetermine an outcome. They treat people fairly without putting their thumb on the scales, and you want sort of people of different persuasions and different tastes and different ideas about the world to be able to enter into a process and agree that it is fair, right? Like that's the sign of one that is working is that it's not that one side thinks it's good and the other side thinks it's bad. It's that both sides can agree. If we do things this way, I can accept the results. And so this is something that libertarians, I do think, care about a lot more than certainly sort of partisans or ideologues of other political persuasions. And it's one of the reasons we emphasize the Constitution and the Bill of Rights in particular, because the Constitution lays out a process like that is supposed to be a process that leads to good results. And leads, in fact, to a result that libertarians like, which is that people have freedom and that individuals have the freedom to act, right? This is also one of the reasons why we are so concerned about the new right or the nationalist conservatives, the NatCons that Stephanie Slade has been writing about, because fundamentally their argument is, well, the process we have, the country we have, the government, the Constitution we have, you know, it's not delivering the outcomes we want. And therefore, we should ditch it in favor of, I don't know, something else. Just it doesn't really matter what, as long as we get the outcomes we want. And that's terrible. And, you know, I do think that libertarians sometimes have trouble describing the ideal world we want because we're focused on process. But in part, what we want are processes that are outcomes. And in particular, we want people to be able to have choices, because choice, individual choice, allowing it in as many realms as possible and devolving choice down to the individual level whenever you can, that is a process in and of itself, of course, but it's also an outcome, and it's a good outcome, and it's the one that we are looking for from our processes.
I will answer the question as follows. When I worked for the Los Angeles Times newspaper in 2006 and 2007 on the opinion and editorial pages, had a very good superior editor who used to use the phrase with some derision, process liberals. Oh, he's just one of those process liberals, by which means someone who's sort of fixated on, you know, old rules and due process and things like that. And part of the derision strove for or derived from that those people are sort of predictable and boring, but also that they lack a certain resonance, attractiveness in their argument. They're not appealing to people's emotions. They're appealing to their other parts of their brain. And I always thought then and now that that should be worn as more of a badge of honor, a process anyone, in part because you need people who are not primarily concerned with the emotional political resonance of their arguments, not primarily. This is not to say that they shouldn't be secondarily concerned with that, because of course you want an audience and you want to persuade people, you want to activate people, you want to identify where people are at and talk about the things that they care about in language that they understand, yes. But you also need process people because they can be the kind of the holders of the pendulum as it's swinging one way to the other. Does that make sense, Catherine?
Actually, yeah, that one's fine.
You need people who remind the frothers on both sides. And right now we have an active anti-due process sentiment on right and left. That's what illiberalism is. That's what we're talking about. The move towards moral clarity in journalism, to cite one example, is, you know, we need to be able to use the maximalist adjectives to deride conservatives as being racist, fascist, or whatever. That is not a way towards the sort of notion, the culture of due process, which is to say, got to prove it. You know, you can't just pile on someone and do some kind of swarming against the bad person and assume that what the bad people are going to do is bad and therefore jump prematurely to conclusions and sometimes bending the facts towards that. You need the process people in that. I think there's some degree to which libertarianism, in my mind at least, it's fine, or it should be self-aware that at various times it's going to be unpopular. It just is. It's going. People get bummed out or irritated by those who say, "Yeah, you know what? You can't just punish your enemies with government. That's bad. That's a bad process, and that's a bad result too, by the way." But like that irritates people because they want to exercise power. We are kind of anti-power in that sense. So wear it with pride, because that's not the primary driver is not to hold the most power and then wield it. It just isn't. So that's one aspect of it. And the other, though, is that there is a result and a process in the Declaration of Independence called life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That is not, life, liberty, and you get this. No, what you get is latitude to pursue it as you see fit. That is a result that we want. And we're going away from that in several respects in terms of government policy. And we're going toward it in several respects in terms of culture and technology and wealth and speech. So that tension is with us all the time, but I'm not worried that, you know, that we are lonely out here. Sometimes it's good to be lonely and then to remind other people that they need to come back from their craziness at this moment. Come back to the process, weirdos. It's okay. All right. Let's go to it's going to be a lightning round now about the California State Assembly. I know that's exciting for everybody, but on Thursday, the lower house of the California Parliament, although that's not what it's called, passed by a 55-6 vote the so-called Journalism Preservation Act, which would require tech companies like Facebook and Twitter to pay news publishers like the LA Times and San Francisco Chronicle a user fee for linking to their content or reposting bits of it. The bill passed despite threats from Facebook's parent company, which is still called Meta for some reason, to just stop posting news in California if the bill passed or bill becomes law. Similar legislation has already passed in Australia and Canada and other places that don't cherish the process or results of freedom. Peter, it says right there in the bill that this would preserve journalism, so why don't you support it?
Oh, I think you got to trust bill titles always. if you want to find out what a bill is going to do, just look at the title.
Yeah. The Good newspaper advice. Preservation,
the Chinese Exclusion Act worked pretty well.
They're more honest back then, Nick. You know that.
Look, so this bill is basically a link tax. It says that if there are links going back to links from large social media companies going back to news websites, then the social media companies are going to have to pay the journalism providers in order to have those on their website. So you know what is going to happen? The social media companies are just going to prohibit news companies from posting links to their stuff on the website. They're going to just ban it completely. They're not going to pay the tax. And then the news companies will not only not make the money, they will also be seen by even fewer people. It is the dumbest possible idea for saving journalism.
Nick, what is it about California? I mean, what was the SB6? That's the one where we're going to protect Uber drivers by not having any anymore.
Yeah, by making it more expensive to hire them. I'll also throw in, just related to kind of web activity, California is also pushing AB 2273, the age-appropriate design code that will require websites with users in California to figure out, you know, what the age is of people who are using it. There is something deeply wrong with California, and particularly Gavin Newsom, where they, you know, this is supposed to be the state of the American dream, and where wide, you know, there are wide open horizons, and it's anything but. It is, a slow moving nightmare of just squeezing down business and individual liberty. You know, when you tax something, you generally get less of it. And, you know, and then when you start to demand more and more bizarre things of business providers, they provide less and less stuff. It's really bad. And I think it is probably, under current management, California is not going to change. They're in the position where New York was 50 years ago or 60 years ago, not recognizing that they are no longer at the forefront of American culture and business and life. And they can't just extract bigger and bigger, things out of the people who live there. People are leaving for good reason, and businesses are following them too.
Catherine, two-part question. First part is, Reason is based in California. Are we threatened? Do you know? And then second part, should there be an outright ban on every bill that has the word journalism in it?
As far as I know, we are not specifically threatened by this bill, other than the way that all news providers are threatened by this bill, which is the mechanism Peter described. Yes, we should ban all bills with journalism in the name. I just want to bring to this discussion a quote from the bill's author.
Did you need the end of that sentence, though?
Never. I always...
Should we just ban all bills?
Yeah. And in fact, this, to speak to that point, the bill's author, Buffy Wicks of Oakland...
Buffy Wicks. Great name.
...concluded her argument in favor of the bill by saying doing nothing is not an option. And I just want to say it really is. Like, in so many areas of life, of the law, just like, has everyone given due and serious consideration to doing nothing? Is my plea to Buffy and to you today.
I'm going to send you a clip of that when we get to our next magazine deadline.
Yeah. All right. All right.
Do nothing process libertarianism 2024. Vote today.
Honestly,
you'll be glad you did.
Yes. I don't know. Like, have we considered, like, oh, Target is selling bathing suits with like penis pockets? Have you considered doing nothing? There's a rainbow on your Bud Light can. Have you considered doing nothing? Like, just think about it.
That's the pull quote from this thing. It's the clip. Out there, social media workers at Reason, floating in the cloud. Check it out. All right, let's go to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural arena. Nick, why don't you lead us off?
Yeah, so I am reading a fantastic book called Psychonauts, Drugs and the Making of the Modern Mind by Mike Jay. And Mike Jay is a great kind of historian of pharmaceuticals, for lack of a better term. And this is a... it's a fantastic look, particularly starting in the 19th century and doing a deep dive into the way that scientists were trying to figure out, how does the mind and the body connect, and what kind of unity or what kind of duality is there. And, you know, it's people like William James who experimented heavily with ether and laughing gas and all sorts of things to kind of understand basic, you know, kind of human processing of things. It's a fantastic book because particularly a figure like William James, but also Sigmund Freud and others, people who kind of created the architecture by which we talk about consciousness, were heavily involved in experimenting with mind-altering chemicals, and that legacy persists. There's so much interesting stuff going on, not just simply with, you know, psychedelics and things like that, but all sorts of drugs that are allowing us to either tap into who we think we are, who we want to be, how to maximize our potential, our, you know, all sorts of things. So highly recommend Psychonauts, Drugs and the Making of the American Mind by Mike Jett.
Peter, what have you been consuming?
I watched Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Folks, this is possibly the best Spider-Man movie ever made, maybe the best comic book movie ever made, or at least the first half of one. So without spoiling too much, there's another one coming next year, and that's going to resolve some things. It's shockingly wonderful, and it's just such a delight to watch. And I think it does a couple of things that are worth noting on this podcast in particular, one of which is that it uses diversity well. And so there's been a lot of talk about diversity in Hollywood over the past couple of years, and in particular with last week's Little Mermaid remake, which I did also see. And last week's Little Mermaid remake is just an exercise in dull box checking, like diversity box checking. There's no point to it. It doesn't really make sense. Even a lot of the sort of liberal critics are like, what is going on here with King Triton having all of these princess daughters that are like somehow or another like a cast of Benetton models, right? Like but all from the same mom. And then also there's a new black queen, except she rules over the Caribbean during like the slave era. I mean, it's bizarre, and it's also really dull and kind of terrible. And then you get to Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, which posits a world of infinite Spider-Man, Spider-Men and Spider-Women and Spider-Pigs and Spider-Things and Spider-People, Spider-Somethings, right? And what it does is it just leans into the absolutely wacky, wonderful individuality of all of these different incarnations of Spider-Man. And it says that they share some things, sure, but that each one of them is irrepressibly an individual, and that that's why diversity is important, and that that's why diversity is good, is because you get more weird, wonderful individuals. And it's a movie about weird, wonderful individualism and the way that it finds a way to express itself and to come out, even if every single person is a Spider-Man. And it's also just so creatively wonderful. Like there's a big twist at the end that is genuinely tense. There's bits of animation where, like, as a longtime kind of comic book geek, I'm like, I can't believe they have figured out how to translate this on screen in something that is not like an experimental art film. Just stuff that I would never have dreamed would be in $100 million production. And it's just great in every way. If you like fun, if you like individualism, if you like multiverses, if you like comic books, if you like Spider-Man, I cannot recommend Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse enough.
Wow. I'm psyched about that because the first of those movies I just adored. I thought it was so wonderful and interesting and great. So we'll happily go and watch that. Catherine?
There are so many great gags for old school comic book heads. And it's not just that Spider-Man 2099 is at the center of this. It's like there's a whole bit with the Spider-Mobile, and I admittedly, I have like a really strong personal emotional connection to Spider-Man.
Sure, keep your web holstered, Peter. Catherine, what did you consume?
I started listening to the podcast Sounds Like a Cult. And it's exactly what the name suggests. It's basically investigations into various, mostly commercial social movements that have cult-like aspects. Of course, always as I am listening, I am channeling Reason's own Jesse Walker, who wrote a fantastic piece about what it means to be a cult and what things are and are not cults a couple years ago, which we will link in the show notes. But like, is SoulCycle a cult? Is the royal family a cult? Disney adults? Question mark. I think that everything feels like a cult these days. Certainly the you're in or you're out aspect of our political culture and so many of the things that we were talking about in the first half of this podcast. And this is a somewhat lighthearted way to try and sort out some of that stuff. Sounds like a cult.
So because of last week's surprising and frankly disturbing amount of discussion of Matt Welch's musical tastes, I felt like I had to play into the stereotype. And I watched a documentary from 2022. It's produced by Vice News, RIP, called Meet Me in the Bathroom. It is a documentary about the rise of New York bands, rock bands, in the early aughts, the Strokes, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Interpol, and such. Many in Brooklyn and Williamsburg. And it's great little documentary, very kind of cinema verite, because there's a lot of people holding shaky cams at various moments in different people's careers. It was interesting for me to watch it because these bands rose up in the late 90s and then in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And it becomes 9/11 becomes a pretty gripping part of it, central to it. It reminds me of Nick's great essay about art and culture after 9/11 and how it largely failed us in sort of transmitting or absorbing that blow, with the exception of the movie. What was it called, Nick? The documentary about Philippe, what's his face, the Walker guy?
Man on Wire,
which is wonderful film. I would throw this one in that at least the category. It's not nearly as good. Man on Wire is a tremendous piece of art. But 9/11 plays a huge role in this. It was interesting to me at the time that these guys were coming out. I was playing in rock bands and more than that, hanging out with a lot of people who were striving to make it big. And when we saw these New York fancy lads go from 0 to 100 in about a week and a half, there was a lot of resentment. But also, you know, everyone kind of liked the Strokes and their throwback type of sound. And it's just interesting to watch that. And you almost never see in rock documentaries the moment, the several moments before everything goes on fire, like their origins, they're working things out before they make it big. And then you know them already by the time they start finding some success. That little intervening period is really interesting to watch them process or just like fall apart as part of that. So Meet Me in the Bathroom, it's based on a 2017 book that I have not read by Lizzie Goldman of the same name that has gotten very good reviews. It's directed by Will Lovelace and Dylan Southern. It's Vice News. I think it's available basically everywhere. I saw it on an airplane, which is a great place to see that, Matt, one, because you got headphones in. Yes.
Matt, was it a unisex bathroom or was it what kind of bathroom is it?
It's based on a song title by The Strokes, yes, from a 2003 song.
I am trying to do a callback to the very beginning of this podcast, Matt Welch.
Yeah, we every bathroom, if the club is bad enough, and they were, the Mercury Lounge, I think it's default unisex bathroom with lots of vomiting and cocaine. That's all the vomiting and cocaine that we have time for on the Reason Roundtable podcast. But we also do all kinds of other stuff, including events in New York City. Nick Gillespie, are there some events in New York City that you would like to promote during this part of the podcast?
Sure. But what I will do, because the timing is a little bit skitsy for today, go to reason.com/events. Because the event that we're having today, Matt, will probably have already started or possibly be over by the time people start listening to this podcast.
They listen to it as soon as it comes out, Nick. I don't know what you're talking about. I will guarantee you that there will be people there tonight, and I know her name.
All right. Then go to reason.com/events, and you will find a great event that we are doing. That's the doors open at 7 p.m. in Midtown Manhattan at the Blue Building, a live interview with Kat Timpf, the Gutfeld and Fox News contributor, hardcore libertarian at Fox News, whose new book, You Can't Joke About That, is a Bravura bestseller. Come out. Go to reason.com/events. Buy a ticket.
Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Go to reason.com podcast for all of our stuff. In that variety, go to reason.com. Donate to give us all the money so Catherine can get some new hair dye and journalists and such. And thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.